Welcome to Beyond the Filter, a podcast about censorship. I'm Brandy.
And I'm Jeremy. And today we're diving into a topic that's both urgent and deeply misunderstood: tech-facilitated gender-based violence. It may not be a familiar phrase to everyone, but you've almost certainly seen the symptoms, especially with the recent scandal involving Grok, the AI chatbot on X, generating deep-faked images of women and girls with their clothing removed. It's a moment that's forced a lot of people to confront how quickly this technology is evolving and how unprepared we are for the harms it can create. Today, we have a special guest to talk about this topic, Sophia Bonilla, who's the Strategy and Partnerships Lead at the Integrity Institute. Welcome, Sophia.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So, Sophia, you're the Strategy and Partnerships Lead at the Integrity Institute, and one of your major responsibilities is managing the Institute's research workflow on tech-facilitated gender-based violence, or TFGBV. Before we get into the specifics, could you start by telling us a bit about your work and how you came to focus on this area?
So I've always been interested in human rights, particularly women's rights. And while I was studying for my master's, I started to see and understand the way that gender-based violence cuts across so many different areas, you know, policy, law, finance, politics, international development. And it really showed me how complex this issue is and how it demands serious investment, coordination, and solutions tailored to specific contexts, rather than a one-size-fits-all approach. And as you mentioned, I work at the Integrity Institute, which is a community-powered think tank and membership organization made up of trust and safety leaders. At the Institute, I've been able to focus specifically on how gender-based violence shows up in digital spaces and how human rights violations take new forms online.
And for listeners who may be hearing the term for the first time, how do you define tech-facilitated gender-based violence? What distinguishes it from more traditional forms of gender-based violence that people might already be familiar with?
So I typically refer to the United Nations Population Fund definition of TFGBV, and I'll just go ahead and read that quickly. It defines TFGBV as an act of violence perpetrated by one or more individuals that is committed, assisted, aggravated, or amplified in part or fully by the use of information and communication technologies or digital media against a person on the basis of gender. It's very long, but I think it's a necessary piece to highlight. Essentially, it amounts to acts of violence motivated by gender perpetrated through technology. So TFGBV is a continuation of some of the same harmful gender norms that we see offline, just reproduced in digital spaces, but it's different from traditional forms of GBV in that there are no geographical constraints.
Could you give us some examples of what counts as TFGBV beyond image manipulation?
Yes, so TFGBV encapsulates a lot of different harms. It includes, you know, intimate image-based abuse, online harassment and cyberbullying, doxing, impersonation, hate speech, online grooming. I've seen some TFGBV resources name, you know, the Internet of Things as a way that people can fall victim to TFGBV, where, you know, partners are putting air tags unknowingly into someone's bag or in their car. I think it's a kind of a frightening thing to think about, because there are so many different ways that women and girls and people of marginalized groups are being targeted based on their gender, and new ways are being invented every day, as we've seen with AI generated deepfakes.
I noticed that it is gender-based violence rather than violence against women specifically, and I wonder if you could tell us a bit more about how transgender and gender diverse individuals may have specific harms from TFGBV.
Yes. So this is a topic I'm slightly less familiar with, but from what I understand, the transgender community is routinely targeted based on, you know, based on their gender, based on how they present themselves online. And really is, I think the main source of harm is harassment and hate speech. I think that type of weaponized speech is really being used against the transgender community. And oftentimes, you know, in certain countries and in different environmental contexts, people are using, you know, their online presence to track down transgender people and find them offline and find out where they live and where they work. And so it's a really, really scary and dangerous situation. And I think it's very serious you know, not just for women and girls, but like you said, from the transgender community as well.
So is TFGBV like a subset of a broader understanding of how tech can facilitate new ways for us to harm each other in general?
I don't necessarily see it as a subset. I think it is, but I mean, I think that is one way to think about it. You know, the way that technology interacts with and changes the way that human rights are violated or honored is really, you know, evolving constantly. And I think gender-based violence is something that has been, you know, continuously has fought for the spotlight pre the internet. And for years, you know, it's been women and girls and activists have fought to enshrine it into law. And I think that now that the internet is so prevalent in our lives, it's been really shocking to see just how the issue has exploded, especially during the COVID pandemic when everyone was forced online. You know, the way that we interacted with each other changed in so many ways. And so I think you can see it as a subset, but I do see it just as a continuous evolution of the way that we interact with one another and the way that our human rights are dealt with and how seriously we take them as a global community.
Is TFGBV always conducted maliciously and intentionally, or is it possible to accidentally commit TFGBV?
You know, I think that question makes me think of the issue of education around these issues. You know, I'm sure there is an instance where someone, you know, makes a comment online and they're not aware of the weight that it carries, perhaps, if you're maybe asking questions about transgender people and like how they live their lives, and maybe something flags that as hate speech on Facebook, if a comment is flagged as hate speech, but it was really just a genuine question in a discussion about transgender issues. I think that is definite possibility, especially when you're trying to do your due diligence and create a safe space, whether it's on Facebook or another platform. But I will venture to say that most of TFGBV is done maliciously.
When you look at the data and causes you studied, who ends up being the most vulnerable to TFGBV? How do factors like age, ethnicity, gender identity, or even just being a public figure or a girl in high school shape the risks?
So I think the first thing that's important to acknowledge is just the sheer scale of TFGBV overall. We're not talking about smaller isolated problems. Data from the Global Partnership for Action on Gender-Based Online Harassment and Abuse shows that about 85% of women and girls have experienced some form of online abuse, but that vulnerability is not evenly distributed. As you mentioned, people are often targeted based on who they are or how they're perceived online. Things like gender identity, race, religion, sexuality, age, or gender expression play an important role. Transgender and gender diverse people in particular experience the highest rates of tech facilitated abuse. Importantly, age also plays a huge role. So surveys of girls ages 13 to 24 across multiple countries show that more than 80% have either seen or received unwanted sexual images or videos, or have been sent inappropriate sexual messages. So just being a girl in high school already puts you at a significant risk. Visibility is another major factor. Journalists, human rights defenders, and activists are often targeted because online abuse is used as a way to silence them or push them out of public spaces. So the same is true for women in public life. And then there's language and culture. A lot of online safety tools and moderation systems are primarily trained in English. That means that women and girls who use other languages often don't get the same level of protection, and their abuse is more likely to go undetected or unaddressed. And similarly, platform elements and systems are usually trained to uphold Western norms, which don't necessarily align with the realities of all of their users.
And beyond the immediate shock or humiliation, what do we know about the psychological, social, and economic impacts on victims, especially in cases involving non-consensual image manipulation, which can spread so fast and be so hard to contain?
The impact is often long-lasting and goes far beyond the initial shock or humiliation. In some countries, women are actually punished or stigmatized for images that were shared without their consent, which can put their safety, reputation, and even their livelihoods at risk. So the harm isn't just personal, it can be structural and economic. On a psychological level, TFGBV can be devastating. Survivors commonly experience anxiety, depression, trauma, and PTSD. And in severe cases, it can often lead to self-harm or suicide attempts. And when you're dealing with non-consensual image manipulation, the harm is intensified because the content can spread so quickly and feel so impossible to fully contain. And a lot of times people may withdraw from their communities or live in a constant state of fear and mistrust. That loss of safety and stability can reshape how someone moves throughout the world. Finally, there's also a huge economic and civic impact. Many women and girls end up self-censoring, limiting their online presence, or stepping back from public and professional life altogether. They might avoid certain jobs or stop engaging in advocacy or digital spaces entirely. So this silencing effect is one of the most serious consequences of TFGB.
So it sounds like victims tend to experience this as more than just a one-off incident, right? It's more like something that follows them indefinitely, something that can resurface and that they have to keep on fighting.
Exactly. TFGBV often takes place in a continuum where actions that start in the digital space may lead to offline gender-based violence and vice versa. So the multiple recurring and interrelated forms of GBV throughout women's lives should signify the severity of this issue and really speaks to the stress and psychological damage that can occur from these problems.
We've seen a huge rise in AI-based image generation and editing tools over the last few years. How has this changed the landscape? What new risks or dynamics are emerging because of these technologies?
So AI image generation and editing tools have really changed the scale and speed of intimate image abuse. These tools are cheap, easy to use, widely available, and have led to a sharp rise in things like nudification and other forms of manipulated content. So someone no longer needs a real image to cause harm. They can just create one and use it to threaten or control someone, even if it's completely fake. And as we've stated, you know, once an image is out there, manipulated or not, it can be incredibly hard to contain it. And, you know, these images are subject to cultural norms and ideas about gender. What counts as explicit or shameful isn't necessarily universal. In some contexts, even a non-sexual image can have devastating consequences. For example, a photo of a woman holding hands with a man might be seen as normal in one place, but it could really put her, you know, reputation and safety at risk in another. So AI doesn't just introduce these technical risks, but it amplifies existing social ones.
Is what AI is doing fundamentally different from practices like photoshopping someone's head onto a naked body, or even physically cutting out a photo of their head and attaching it to a photo of another body? Or is AI simply making the same kind of manipulation faster, easier, and more accessible?
I want to say more of the latter. You know, in many ways, it's an evolution rather than a completely new phenomenon. As you said, you know, image manipulation existed before, but what AI does is really change the speed and the realism of these sorts of images. Whereas, you know, before you needed a certain level of technical skill and time to create a convincing fake image using Photoshop or something like that, and now AI can do it for you. So the number of people who can create harmful content expands dramatically, and the volume of abuse has really increased.
Let's shift to the Grok scandal, because it's become a kind of case study for the broader issues that we're talking about. For listeners who may not have followed the story closely, can you walk us through what happened with X's Grok chatbot and how it ended up generating non-consensual sexualized images?
Sure. So the Grok scandal really highlights how mainstream platforms can amplify TFGBV. And essentially, X's Grok chatbot allowed users to manipulate images shared on the platform by simply replying to a photo and asking Grok to create a sexualized version. So this could mean changing a photo of someone with their family or a woman just on a hike and putting them in a bikini or in underwear and altering their bodies. There have also been reports that it was used to create sexualized images of children, which is extremely concerning. And what also makes this so alarming is how public and widely accessible it was. You know, the tool is free and available to millions of users directly on the X platform. So anyone can use it without needing special technical skills, as we discussed. And you could also watch this abuse unfold in real time.
Given everything we already know about the risks of AI image tools, why do you think Grok was able to generate or edit images to undress real people, including women and minors? Was this a failure of safeguards or something deeper?
But Grok's ability to generate these images reflects both a failure of safeguards and deeper societal issues. When Elon Musk purchased X, he then rolled back many of the trust and safety protections and the investment in those teams internally, which clearly have played a role in enabling this kind of abuse at such a large scale. And it also reflects that the broader systemic misogyny that exists in our society, the attitudes and behaviors that devalue and sexualize women and girls are amplified online when platforms fail to intervene. So Grok is an example of how technology can really mirror and magnify these social harms when those safeguards aren't in place.
So it sounds like this wasn't just a technical failure, more of a governance or a values failure, or some combination of all three.
That's right. So the technical tools to prevent this kind of harm already exist, especially at scale. Trust and safety expert Dave Wilner has said, with the tools now available, it is entirely possible to deal with this problem. Not doing so is a choice, which I thought was a very well said evaluation of this problem in this specific instance. You know, trust and safety strategies are built to address these issues, and there are people working tirelessly behind the scenes at platforms to make sure this doesn't appear online, this kind of abuse. So it seems to me that this is a governance failure, meaning the choice was made to skirt safeguards in favor of engagement or going viral.
So there's also been a lot of debate about whether Grok generated CSAM or child sexual abuse material. Elon has pushed back against that idea, saying that there were no naked underage images generated by Grok, literally zero. But that raises a bigger question. Is that really the standard? Because there's content that's abusive but not illegal, and there's also content that's illegal but not always recognized as abusive. So where do images of real minors depicted in underwear or swimsuits but created without consent fall on that spectrum?
So, you know, that's a tricky question, and I'm not a child safety expert, so I'm not quite sure how to answer that. There are lots of people at the Integrity Institute who dedicate time and have extensive expertise on child safety who would be better suited to answer that. But I do think the presence of this gray area content that you're raising is incredibly important and should, it should signify that there should be investment in these trust and safety teams so that there are people who understand how to deal with content that we call borderline content that might be violative and might not be, and that would require human review. And, trust and safety teams need the necessary resources in order to be that safeguard, which, as we've seen, when that's not there, we can issues like Grok's nudification spiral will happen.
I think it's an interesting conversation that we're having, because oftentimes on this podcast, we're talking about gray areas of censorship, and often we'll come down on the other side of the argument to say, we need to be more resistant to censorship. But I think the thing that makes a difference here is that we are talking about photos of real victims that are being manipulated. They're not purely fantasy works, and they're certainly not being, there are no safeguards. Like, one of the other things that we often promote is, if there is going to be triggering content, have content warnings, have some tagging, have some filtering. If you went into the replies on Grok, you would have just seen with no filters these images being posted. But stepping back from Grok specifically, what role do you think that social media platforms play or should play in enabling or combating TFGBV? And under current laws, what responsibilities do they actually have?
Social media platforms play a central role in both enabling and combating TFGBV. Their design choices, how content is ranked, how reporting works, what behavior is incentivized, really shapes whether abuse is amplified. Platforms have historically been slow to adopt such safety features. They often act after significant public outcry. Twitter introduced its report button in 2013, which was 7 years after its launch. Instagram didn't include a mute button until 2018. And this timeline reflects a broader issue in the industry, which is in the corporate race to move fast and break things. Protecting vulnerable users has often been an afterthought. So, and the reality is that many of the tools to address TFGBV already exist. In a report that I co-authored last year called Prevention by Design, we documented a range of interventions from content filters to user nudges to algorithmic redesign that already exist and can meaningfully reduce harm across different platforms. So it's less of a question of technical feasibility and more of a question of whether companies choose to implement these tools at scale.
Looking ahead, what lessons should other AI companies, whether that's OpenAI, Meta, or anyone else building generative tools, take from the Grok incident? What should they be doing differently right now?
So platforms need to be taking a proactive look at their own tooling by anticipating how their services could be misused and putting safeguards in place before harm occurs. One effective method that stands out to me here is red teaming. Jen Whedon, who is a seasoned trust and safety professional and a lecturer at Columbia University, defines red teaming as a structured approach that employs adversarial thinking, meaning intentionally adopting the perspective of an opponent or critic to stress test assumptions and expose hidden risks. And I think it's an incredibly valuable technique that should be employed in most cases. But one thing Jen Whedon points out as well is that the question is whether companies are genuinely interrogating system level risk or if they're primarily engaging in things like red teaming as just to check a box or just to satisfy some external accountability ritual. So it's critical that these processes are implemented in a meaningful way.
And we're talking about child exploitation in particular. The point has been made by others that red teaming actually faces some legal obstacles because it might be illegal for the red team to operate to try and generate images. And if they can't do that, then they're a step behind before they even start. So I think lawmakers need to take a look at that. There are some other reforms as well that I think trust and safety professionals could benefit from so that they're not exposed to liability for just fleeting possession of content that might be illegal if it's in the purpose of their duties. And at the moment, those protections don't really exist. I mean, there's kind of an informal non-prosecution policy, I guess. But that's cold comfort when you're dealing with such, you know, life-altering charges as possession of child abuse images.
I know that a lot of platforms have really close ties to law enforcement in this capacity to deal with these types of issues. And the National NCMEC, which I think the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, does a lot of important work in this area. And I think that is, you know, that's something that comes up a lot, is exactly your point. You know, how do you combat these harms without, you know, without breaking the law? And I think that's a really tricky situation that should be addressed in order to stop the prevalence of CSAM.
Well, here's my problem with here's one of my problems with what X has done, and that's that they've just made it easier for authorities to overstep and, you know, ban all AI content that could be sexual or make other sort of overcorrections like this and potentially throwing the baby out with the bathwater. I mean, if X hadn't been so overt, they wouldn't have necessarily pushed that conversation forward in the way that I think it's been moved forward. And as a result, even after this specific problem is gone, its echoes are going to be heard for a long time. And I think that's going to affect the way that policy develops. So I wanted to ask you, how effective are the existing legal frameworks in addressing TFGBV? And where do you think we see the biggest gaps, either in enforcement or in the laws themselves?
So I think, first of all, it's a huge step forward that TFGBV is explicitly addressed in major legal and regulatory frameworks. Naming these harms in law legitimizes them and really creates formal pathways for accountability, especially for victims whose experiences had been previously minimized or dismissed. But I do think the biggest gaps in addressing TFGBV mirror those that we see across digital harms more broadly, namely uneven enforcement and, you know, where governments and companies are still negotiating what regulation looks like in practice. You know, how are these responsibilities allocated? What does compliance with the law actually mean and look like? How quickly must certain actions be taken in order to fulfill their duties? That process takes time. To me, I think that the biggest challenge in this space right now is ironing out those details. And unfortunately, while the frameworks are being refined, people are going to continue to be victim to TFGBV. So it's crucial that this happens efficiently and quickly.
So do you think that the Grok incident will influence future regulations around AI image generation? And if so, what specific changes would you recommend policymakers consider?
Yes, I do think that the Grok incident has broader implications for how AI image generation will be regulated. You know, we're already seeing the introduction of some AI legislation in the United States. Some of it is anti-regulation. I believe President Trump signed an executive order banning state-level AI regulation. So there's a lot going on at the moment. There's a lot of discussion, but this is definitely coming into play, at least at the international level. The UK Office of Communications is already opening an investigation into Grok, and the European Commission has issued document retention orders and warnings under the Digital Services Act. So a lot of people are paying attention to this, and I hope that it does serve as a warning and lend some guidance to the development of different AI regulation so that this doesn't happen again. But looking ahead, one of the key changes that I would recommend is requiring stronger, more specific transparency requirements of platforms. If policymakers ask for clear metrics from platforms about how their AI systems are designed and deployed and how those governance decisions are made, I think that would be a real game changer. That would include reporting on the scale, cause, and nature of abuse on those platforms and how they're facilitated by their tools, and getting very, in some instances, very granular, so that the government or the policymakers can really understand and enact meaningful transparency requirements in that way.
So X has dropped the ball, but how are some other platforms or companies handling this better? Maybe not perfectly, but are there any that are at least showing signs of taking this issue more seriously?
So I think Blue Sky is a good example. It's really built around user empowerment and emphasizes feed customization and moderation tools. And it really gives people the ability to filter content and avoid harmful topics in their feed, which can really meaningfully reduce your exposure to abuse. We're also seeing new platforms pop up specifically designed for women or people of marginalized groups so that their safety is prioritized at the outset. But that does involve abandoning these more traditional and popular platforms. Otherwise, in terms of the AI-generated content, I'm not sure who is the most responsible of the different AI-generating tools. I haven't especially heard of any of them doing a great job right now, but could be the case that some are being more responsible than others. I hope that there is a good example.
For individuals, especially women and girls, who are disproportionately targeted, are there steps they can take to protect themselves? Or is this one of those areas where the burden really shouldn't fall on the potential victims?
There are a number of toolkits that can be helpful for users who want to proactively protect themselves. So Chayn, C-H-A-Y-N, is a UK nonprofit working on online safety for women, and they've created a digital safety guide that is incredibly helpful as a really good example of a resource like that, that can provide practical support for people who want to take charge of their digital environment. But that being said, you're absolutely right. The burden of protection should not rest on victims. Platforms should be obligated to protect the rights and safety of their users. And while individual coping strategies are helpful, they're not a substitute for systemic safeguards. And treating them as such risks shifting responsibility away from the companies that design and profit systems that perpetuate harm.
Sophia, thank you so much for your time and for the work that you're doing. So before we wrap up, is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners? Maybe where they can follow your work or learn more about TFGBV?
Yeah, so I would say if you want to talk about TFGBV and what the Integrity Institute has done in this field, you can follow me on LinkedIn or connect with me there. I also recommend following the Institute for Strategic Dialogue and the Sexual Violence Research Initiative to keep up with new developments in the TFGBV field.
Add those links to the show notes. So thanks very much again, Sophia.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Sophia. It's been wonderful to have you. This has been Beyond the Filter. If you found this episode useful, share it, especially with people who still think these issues are just online. Until next month, it's goodbye from me.
And goodbye from me.